Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. Ray Schwab here working the board for us and going to join us as my co-host. Hi, Ray.
I'm good.
Doing well. And I'm John Pierce. We have a very special topic this evening that we're going to bring you, and that is studying the history of medicine. I bet you never thought about that. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Wilson, who is professor of history at Muhlenberg College. And let's tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Wilson is a polio survivor. He has written three books on polio epidemics. One is Living with Polio, the Epidemic and Its Survivors, from 2005. He co-authored Polio Voices, an Oral History from the American Polio Epidemics and Worldwide Eradication Efforts, 2007. And finally, Polio Biography of a Disease from 2009. Dan, welcome to our microphones.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Is this your first time in eclectic South Bethlehem?
Not the first time in eclectic South Bethlehem. We regularly come over to Godfrey Daniels, so another good part of South Bethlehem.
Yes. Have you ever been there for a Godfrey Daniels Live that we broadcast?
No, I haven't been there for that.
But you like that venue.
We like the venue a great deal.
All right. And then when he says we, that's Dan and his wife, Dr. Carol Shiner Wilson, also lately of Muhlenberg College. And I suppose that for her this is required listening, Dan.
Yes, it is.
So I'm going to ask Ray if he will read the very beginning of the first chapter of Dr. Wilson's book, Polio Biography of a Disease.
September of 1945 was warm in northern Wisconsin, almost like summer. I was 5 and not yet in school. I remember feeling sick and lying on a cot we kept on our screened-in porch. When I didn't get better after a day or two, my mother phoned the family's doctor. In the 1950s, physicians still made house calls to examine patients, and, before long, Dr. Freeman was beside my cot. He asked me to raise my head off the pillow, and I was unable. There was a worried look on his face, and he did a couple of other tests. Then, he and my parents had a whispered conversation. Soon after the doctor left, my parents informed me that I would be going to the hospital. My father picked me up in his strong arms and carried me to the car. It was a short ride to the hospital where my father had carried me in. At the hospital, I began to cry when I realized that my parents were going to leave me there, as I had never been left anywhere alone before. A nurse picked me up and carried me to a crib. My parents were left outside the room, and I could only see them through the window in the door. I was still crying when they left. Later, I learned that I had come down with polio, one of almost 29,000 cases diagnosed nationwide that year.
Dan, that goes back to 1955, and you were 5 years old at the time.
Yes.
And you remember those details.
Well, it's hard not to remember them when they're so striking. I mean, I had never been left someplace before, had never been in the hospital before. Except when I was born, and of course that I don't remember. So it's quite striking. And then those years, polio patients were put in isolation, which meant that you had no visitors. Your parents couldn't come and visit. Friends couldn't come and visit. And that, of course, was very hard, not only for me, but for all polio patients at that time.
That's a very touching beginning to a book that is called Polio, and it's in a series called Biographies of Disease. Just to give you some context, other titles in that series are Parkinson's disease, depression, diabetes, stroke, autism, rabies, influenza, ADHD, food allergies, anorexia, obesity, and sports injuries. So Dr. Wilson has authored this book in this series called Polio. So, Dan, why is the study of medicine important to you?
Well, I think, first of all, it's intrinsically interesting. I mean, there are great stories in the history of medicine. Part of it is the stories of physicians making discoveries about diseases, figuring out diseases, figuring out what makes the body work, what goes wrong, how to cure diseases. There are also great stories about people who've had the disease. Think of Stephen Hawking, for example, the great physicist who has Lou Gehrig's disease and yet continues to be an active scientist, an active physicist, though he's practically immobile. There have been interesting, a whole variety of interesting films on diseases. For example, My Left Foot, which starred Daniel Day-Lewis, about a young man in England with cerebral palsy. Or more recently, the Sessions, which involved Mark O'Brien, the story of Mark O'Brien, who had polio and spent much of his time in an iron lung. But his sessions with a sex therapist, which was a very powerful film and a very popular film late last year. So they're compelling stories, which makes good history, whether you're looking at it from the point of view of physicians and scientists, or you're looking at it from the point of view of the patients.
And then we, in the area of mental health, we have some very interesting and moving films also.
Right,
Beautiful
right.
Mind comes to my mind. We have a movie coming up at Civic Theater soon, and it's called Almost, now wait a second, what's the title? Nearly Normal.
Right.
And it's not a movie, it's a play. It's a musical play. And I can't wait to see that because of dealing with mental illness and in a musical venue. Now, you're a historian, and you don't do only the history of medicine. In fact, Ray, I have had the very interesting experience of sitting with Dr. Wilson's approval, sitting in on a couple of courses that he's taught. One was called Women and History, Women and the Family in History. And I like that he connects the women and the family, because women are really the rock of the family, Dan,
right.
Correct?
Well, and for much of history, they've been primarily in the family. It's only really in the 19th and 20th century that increasing number of women have taken on roles outside the family. So if you're going to understand women's history, you need to understand them in the evolving history of the family. And the family, like other institutions, has evolved over time. And so there's change, there's a history there that's interesting to follow.
And then also the other course that I attended was on the 19th century. It was Civil War and Reconstruction. So Dr. Wilson is all over the map as far as his history courses are concerned. Dan, what are some of the key developments in the history of medicine?
Well, I think one of the most important developments is really the rise of scientific medicine in the 19th century. Until the 19th century, a lot of physicians were still working on theories that were developed by the Greek philosopher Aristotle, by the Roman physician Galen, who was the second century AD. They had various theories. It was the theory of the humors, that the body was made up of, and health was determined by the balance of, it was blood, phlegm, black bile, and yellow bile, and you were healthy if those four humors were in balance, and sickness was when one of those got out of balance. And so the doctors would try to get you back in balance by bloodletting, for example, if you had too much blood, or purgatives, things to make you vomit, or laxatives and so forth, whatever they thought was appropriate to get you back in balance. So oftentimes if you went to the doctor, you were, in a sense, made more sick than whatever it was that you had gone to see the doctor. But that was the goal of getting you better. By the 19th century, you begin to, scientists and physicians begin to understand the body better physiologically, begin to recognize that the humors had, if they in fact existed, had very little to do with one's health, except in specific instances. So developments like, vaccination against smallpox, Edward Jenner's discovery of vaccination in the late 1790s, the discovery of antisepsis and anesthesia in the middle of the 19th century, so that you could put people under to do surgery. I mean, during the Civil War, for example, anesthesia was typically not used, so that doctors, the greatest skill of a surgeon in the 19th century in the Civil War was speed. Because if you're going to amputate a leg or an arm without anesthesia, you want to do it fast. And so just those kinds of developments, the discovery of x-rays at the end of the 19th century, for example, which allowed doctors to see inside the body without cutting it open. So I would say probably the rise of scientific medicine at the end of the 19th century, the discovery of germs, of bacteria, and later viruses as causes of disease, gave doctors a whole new set of tools with which to understand disease and health, and also then tools to try to cure diseases.
Well, and the role of hospitals has it changed, at least psychologically, for us. I've heard that in the old days, let's call it, probably before the 20th century, a hospital was a place where you went to die.
Yes.
And so you didn't want to go there.
And the only people who went to hospitals were people who couldn't be taken care of at home. So the wealthy, the middle class, were typically taken care of at home. Doctors came to the home, took care of them. You hired a nurse if necessary. It was really only the poor and the indigent who ended up in the hospitals, and most of those who went to the hospitals were carried out in a wooden box rather than walking out themselves. So it's not until the 20th century, really, that hospitals become a place where you go to get cured. And part of that was the developments in science. You can't put an x-ray machine in a doctor's black box and carry it around house to house. They've now got fairly portable ones, but back then, of course, you needed an institution for the x-ray machine. And you can't have an antiseptic operating room in somebody's kitchen. So if you're going to have an antiseptic or an aseptic operating room, you need to do that in an institution. So as medicine changed, hospitals became places to get well instead of places to go to die.
Right, and at the other end of life, birth.
Right.
That used to be done in homes, right?
It's almost always done in homes. You know, my mother was born at home in 1918, but by the 1920s, both of her brothers were born in the hospital. So that change came fairly quickly in the early 20th century.
This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're chatting with Dr. Daniel Wilson, professor of history from Muhlenberg College, about studying the history of medicine. And we've been talking about some of the key developments in the history of medicine and why it's important to study that. Dan, a broader question?
Now, Ray? I just have a question. As you were talking about the significant breakthroughs in medicine in the 19th and the 20th centuries, how does that affect the study of the history of medicine? How does it affect that?
Well, the history of medicine really began with physicians studying their own field, of wanting to understand how their field, whether it was cardiology or pulmonology or whatever it was, going back and studying that history. And so they were primarily interested in particular fields, their fields. It's really only in the 20th century that the history of medicine has broadened out to look at how medicine operates in society, what kind of social institutions it is, what the experience of patients is. And now the history of medicine is done both by physicians who are interested in their own fields, but also by historians trained in the broader context.
So it sort of began as a way, sort of self-examination. And
right.
How has that reflected back and affected the medical field?
Well, I think it's helped the medical field understand that medicine now is a process of continual change and continual improvement. It's not stasis the way it was for centuries, but rather a process of change and improvement over time. And you can trace that improvement if you're looking at at the various particular fields.
We are chatting this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse with Dr. Daniel Wilson from Muhlenberg College. We're talking about the history of medicine. And usually our guest is in here, Ray, with you and me, and that's all. But we have been joined by...
Surprise guest, we should say.
Yes, yes. Bill Dotremont-Smith has joined us. And Bill, what brings you here into our studio at this time?
Well, what brings us, of course, is Pledge Drive, and we are in day four of our Pledge Drive, and we have quite a way to go still, but I have some very good news. I'd like to update from the very end of All Things Considered. We did meet our challenge of the 12, and in fact, we actually hit 13 with a couple of pledges over the web as well.
Hooray.
So let me do give some thanks here. Tess of Schnecksville became a new member. Jeff from Walnutport became a new member. And Christopher of Allentown became a new member over the web, and John of Easton became a new member. Four new members there, and that is absolutely magnificent. The reason we come to you over the air in particular is to get to listeners who are not yet members. We get out to members who we know are in our database. We can mail them, we can call them, and a number of members came through in advance of the pledge drive with a buyback and contributed $15,000 in advance, which saved us in pledging. You had a pledge-free weekend last Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. But we come to you for 6 days over the air now to get to listeners who are not yet members. So if you've been thinking about becoming a member, now is the time to do it. 610-758-8810 or securely online at wdiy.org. And we absolutely do need more membership support. It is critical to us. Some of our revenues have gone down. Federal support has been reduced a little bit by the sequester. Local business support is reduced by the state of the economy. Our expenses do not go down, so we have to fill those gaps, and we absolutely need to grow our listeners becoming member support.
In fact, very, very recently, Bill, I heard you say that our expenses sometimes go up when our listenership goes up.
That's absolutely right. Our expenses for our main NPR programming of Morning Edition and All Things Considered, NPR takes account of the number of listeners we have. They receive the data from Arbitron to know how many listeners we have, and a very, very fair pricing system. The more people we are serving with our programming, the more they charge us for the programming. That's
makes
really
sense.
Fair. As a small station, we don't pay as much as a big station. But so the bad news is our pricing went up because of the good news that our listenership went up. So we're depending on you who are new listeners who are responsible for our expenses going up, our new listeners that we're serving. We are depending on you to become a member and help support the operation of this station to bring you the programming that you listen to every week on WDIY. And we'd like to recommend a couple of levels. Ideally, the $10 a month evergreen sustaining member. We had Earth Day on Monday of this week, and we'd like to push our evergreen sustaining member in that there's no mating. You commit $10 or $15 or $20 a month on your credit card. It goes on in perpetuity until you say stop. There are no renewal notices sent out to you, no paper being used, no postal, no energy for the postage. And at the same time, you know you're an ongoing supporting member of WDIY without the interruption of a possible lapse in your membership.
Ray, what's the telephone number for our listeners to call to pledge?
Well, we'd like to see you pledge, and if you would like to, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. Again, that's 610-758-8810.
And you know, this program, Lehigh Valley Discourse, we frequently feature lots of prominent people, decision makers and leaders in the Lehigh Valley. We frequently had our local politicians on and political candidates. And Ray, I think, do you have some message queued up? Okay, we'll leave it till the next break. Okay, but we do feature many of our prominent leaders on this station, on this particular program, talking about what's happening on the local political scene or as candidates for the upcoming elections. If you value hearing our politicians and other leaders, university leaders that we frequently have on, university professors from many of the colleges in the area here, now is your time to show that support. Make that call, 610-758-8810. And I do have a thank you from one donor within for Lehigh Valley Discourse here. A new donor from Bethlehem pledged early on in Lehigh Valley Discourse. So we have one for Lehigh Valley Discourse. We'd really like to get five contributions during this edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse to keep us on track today.
And so those who would like to pledge online, it's wdiy.org. It's very easy. Takes about 2 minutes of your time.
Absolutely.
Now, like Bill had said, we're going to hear from Bethlehem Mayor John Callahan.
If you can hear my voice, well, then you're a WDIY listener. What we want you to be is a WDIY member. I'm Bethlehem Mayor John Callahan, and I'm a WDIY member because I count on WDIY here in the Lehigh Valley to give me great NPR news, local public affairs, even a little local political coverage, which is hard to find these days, and of course, great music. If you count on WDIY to be there like I do, please do your part to become a member, help the station financially so we can continue to count on WDIY to give us this great local programming.
To make your pledge of support, please call 610-758-8810 or go to WDIY.org.
Please follow Matt Callahan's lead there and make that call, 610-758-8810. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. And now we get back to our topic of the day on Lehigh Valley Discourse, which is studying the history of medicine. I'm very happy to welcome fellow Midwesterner, Dr. Daniel Wilson. As you could hear from Bill's voice, he is not a fellow Midwesterner. Bill, nothing against you. That's okay. And Ray, I guess you're not either, huh?
No.
All right. Well, then, Dan, you and I are 50% of the room right now. Dan is originally from Wisconsin, and I'm from Illinois, so we're neighbors in a certain way. And Dan is a sports fan, right?
Well, I grew up a Green Bay Packer fan in the era of Vince Lombardi, so you were probably a Bears fan, so we would have been
exactly right
on opposite sides.
We were at loggerheads. And so you're proud to be a cheesehead? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, I have no choice, I guess.
And as far as college sports, then it has to be?
University of Wisconsin Badgers, of course.
Okay. Right. The familiar W. So Dan Wilson has written three books, particularly on polio. He's written books also on other subjects. What else have you written on, Dan, besides medicine?
Well, I started work, my graduate work at Johns Hopkins in intellectual and cultural history. I wrote a biography of Arthur Lovejoy, who was a prominent philosopher in the early 20th century. And then I followed that with a book on the impact of science on American philosophy in the late 19th and early 20th century. And then after that, sort of moved into the history of polio.
Now, just before that break, we were touching upon how the study of the history of medicine has affected the medical field, and I want to know, what were some key developments in the history of medicine, whether it be before the 19th century or even into the modern day?
Well, one of the real shifts is moving away from what I'd call, I guess, the institutional history of medicine, which is studying how cardiology developed or how orthopedics developed or how a particular procedure came to be developed, which is where a lot of the physicians have focused, but moving more toward the social history of medicine, how medicine fits in society, how medicine as an institution is part of society. It clearly affects society, but society affects medicine. And, you know, for example, in this country we have fee-for-service is the way you pay for your doctors, and doctors have long resisted third-party interference in that, whether it's insurance or government. In other parts of the world, you know, government pays for health care. There are different ways of doing it. So that's, you know, part of what the history of medicine looks at as well, is how society and medicine interact as we move forward. And more recently, there's been a sort of a offshoot, I guess, a history of medicine, and that is disability history, in looking at the history of disabilities and how society has treated people with disabilities, how people with disabilities have made their way in society. And that's really a very recent development within the last 20 years, probably. The social history of medicine goes back to the 1940s, at least. But
now, in the United States, you had talked about the interaction between medicine and society. What were some of the main differences in that interaction, pre-industrial and post-industrial America?
Well, pre-industrial America, doctors were not terribly well trained. Most doctors learned by being an apprentice to a physician. There were very few medical schools in America. One of the first was in Philadelphia with Benjamin Rush, the end of the 18th century, the 1790s. Most of the medical schools in the 19th century were, I would say, laughable. It was a fairly short course. It was a two-year course of study, maybe 5 months. Most of it was out of books. In most cases, you didn't get to do anatomy at lab. And the second year repeated the first year. In those schools that did have anatomy, you had to provide your own corpse. So that grave robbing was a skill you had to develop if you were going to be a physician and do anatomy. With the rise of industry and in part the rise of philanthropists like Rockefeller and others who were willing to give money to establish medical schools, and the rise of scientific medicine and the need for techniques and technologies like x-rays, for example, the study of medicine becomes much more regularized. And there's a famous study, the Carnegie Foundation in 1910 sponsored a study by Abraham Flexner of medical schools. And he looked at all of the medical schools, studied all the medical schools in the United States at this point, of which there were several hundred. And his standard for judging medical schools was Johns Hopkins, which was established in 1893. On a European, on a German model of a medical school, and in which doctors were paid enough, they didn't have to have a private practice. They had laboratories, research was encouraged. It was the first medical school to require applicants to have a college degree. So it was a much higher level of medical school. And the Flexner report, when he did his report of the several hundred medical schools in the U.S., most failed, most flunked. What the Rockefeller Foundation did then was to provide monies to enable medical schools to come up to the Hopkins standard, or to at least approach it, to require more of an undergraduate degree, to pay their professors sufficiently that they didn't have to have a private practice, to encourage research and these kinds of things. So starting with the Flexner Report in 1910, you really get a revolution in medical education that could produce the kind of doctor that the emerging scientific and biological revolution required. And that is somebody well-grounded in the sciences, who understood physiology and anatomy, who didn't have to go robbing graves to get a corpse to do an anatomy class because it was provided by the medical school. So that Flexner report really brought about a significant change in the way doctors were educated in this country.
And at that point, and you said that was 1910?
1910.
At that point, how did the United States stack up to countries like England or Germany in the medical field?
In the medical field in 1910, the United States didn't stack up very well because Hopkins was one of the few, Hopkins and Harvard and maybe two or three others, the few medical schools which really met a world standard. Germany and England, to some extent France, had hospitals and medical schools, well-established medical schools, for decades, if not centuries. But the United States caught up very quickly. If you look at the Nobel Prizes in physiology and medicine, the United States lags way behind in the early years of the Nobel Prizes. And most of them went to physicians and scientists in Germany, France, and England. By the 1930s and 40s, the United States is holding its own in the Nobel Prizes in physiology and medicine.
In fact, one of the proofs of the importance of Germany in this field is that our medical students had to take some German with their studies. Now, that stopped maybe a generation or so ago.
Well, a lot of ambitious young men and a few ambitious young women in the late 19th century, if they really wanted a good medical education, went to either France, Germany, or England to study in the medical schools there. And this is what gave rise to Hopkins, is physicians who had studied in Germany, knew what a good medical school looked like, came back, used the money that Johns Hopkins had donated for the purpose of a medical school and established, for the first time really, a first-rate medical school in this country.
And you have a PhD from Johns Hopkins.
Not the medical school, but from the university.
Not the medical school, yes. But, and that was in history.
In history.
A particular...
Well, U.S. history, U.S. cultural and intellectual history, basically.
All right. So let's disabuse our listeners of the idea that it's Johns Hopkins.
And it's Johns Hopkins because that was his first name. His parents named him Johns. He was a wealthy Quaker. He was one of the leading stockholders in the B&O Railroad. And when he died, he gave his money for a university and for a medical school. What's interesting about the medical school is that the value of the B&O stock had declined, and there wasn't really enough money to open the medical school. And a group of wealthy Quaker women in Baltimore raised the money to open the medical school to provide an endowment on the condition that Hopkins admit women to the medical school, because most medical schools in the late 19th century did not admit women. But since they were raising the money, they could put that as a condition that Hopkins admit women.
And that's even before the women had the vote in this country. So that was a very progressive university.
Oh, yeah. Now I have a question about, so I'm a musician, and I had studied a lot of music through my time in college and the history of music. And one thing that's come about in the last, say, 50 years or so is ethnomusicology. The idea that the study of Western music has really neglected what's been going on in Asia or in the Middle East. How is Asian and Middle Eastern cultures represented in the history of medicine?
Well, there's a lot of study of those cultures and of indigenous cultures to look at, you know, what kind of medicines they use. Very often indigenous peoples identified various kinds of botanical elements that could be had medicinal uses. And so there's been a lot of study of alternative medical practices, partly just to understand them on their own basis, but also then to see what aspects of those indigenous or folk medicines or alternative medicines could be useful in our medical system.
We want to return to this subject in just a minute, but Bill Dotremont Smith has joined us again, and so I'm going to give Dr. Wilson a little bit of a break here as we talk about pledging to WDIY.
We are looking for your support. We are in fourth day of our pledge drive, our on-air membership drive. And the phones have gone a little bit quiet over the last 30 minutes or so. So we're looking for those of you who appreciate and enjoy Lehigh Valley Discourse every Thursday evening here on WDIY. John Pierce and Ray, our hosts tonight. Alan Jennings, another of our regular rotating hosts who covers our political and social issues. Sally Handlin, another of our regular hosts on this program. Sally covers small business and entrepreneurial and often educational issues. And John tonight often covering a whole range of educational and religious history issues.
Sports
as well, of course. Yes, absolutely. Sports. Yeah, we've also covered the Iron Pigs on here on Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Yes, sir.
So we bring you a lot of influential people within the Lehigh Valley to tell you what's happening in public affairs in the Lehigh Valley. And if you value that, we are now asking you to show your support. Make that call 610-758-8810 or go securely online at wdiy.org.
Right. And our guest tonight, Dr. Wilson and his wife, are members, I understand. Is that right?
We've been members since the very beginning of WDIY, so...
Magnificent.
We're very, very happy to support them.
What do you think so great about WDIY, Dan?
Well, it's wonderful to have a local radio station that has NPR News, that provides local features such as this, that provides great music, classical, alternative music. We often listen on Saturday to the various folk musics. When we're out shopping, we like to have the folk music on Saturday morning. It's, you know, Wegmans and WDIY.
Right.
So, Dan, what would you say the telephone number is for our listeners to call?
610-758-8810.
Dan, you hit on a very good point of localism, and that is a thing that we absolutely try to feature here to differentiate ourselves from the other public radio stations that are available here in the Lehigh Valley. We are the local Lehigh Valley NPR station, and we bring in lots of local personalities and on the music programs, local performers whom you wouldn't hear on the other stations. But we have some really good musicians here in the Lehigh Valley, and we give them a platform on the various programs here on WDIY. We're always having in studio performances and interviews with our local musicians and featuring the local music festivals that we have here and featuring the musical events and doing ticket giveaways for large number of events. And perhaps one of you listening who is not yet a member of WDIY, perhaps you've been a beneficiary of a ticket giveaway. We give away about $18,000 of tickets here on WDIY each year, and we provide services in order to provide those tickets for you. We're not just giving them away free. We are providing services in return for the tickets we give away. Those services cost us money to provide. So we're looking to you now, asking you on this, our spring membership drive, for you to show some love back to WDIY in appreciation for the services we provided to you and the whole Lehigh Valley community over the last 6 months since our last pledge drive. You can show that support by making that call, 610-758-8810. We'd love to hear from four more of you.
Now, a little earlier, we heard from Bethlehem Mayor John Callahan. Now let's hear from Easton Mayor Sal Panto.
Hi, I'm Easton Mayor Sal Panto, and I'm a WDIY member. I'm here today to encourage you to pledge your financial support for WDIY during this membership drive. The station is an important part of our community, providing the entire Lehigh Valley with NPR news, local public affairs programming, and of course, great music. If you count on WDIY to be there like I do, to keep you informed, enlightened, and entertained, please do your part and become a member today.
To make your pledge, please call 610-758-8810 or go to WDIY.org.
Yes, please follow Sal Panto's lead. We are depending on you. Four more calls we'd like to have before the end of Lehigh Valley Discourse. 610-758-8810. Thanks.
And thank you, Bill, for coming in and letting our listeners know that this is Pledge Week, and we do appreciate your support. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, along with Ray Schwab, and we are talking this evening about studying the history of medicine with Dr. Daniel Wilson from Muhlenberg College. Before the break, Ray asked a very interesting question about Western medicine versus other medicines, so to speak, and you were talking about the fact that now we're, Dan, I think you said we're taking into account alternative medicines more than we used to.
Well, for example, you'll have doctors who will recommend acupuncture, for example. Doctors today are also, even within the United States, looking at alternative measures. Chiropractors used to be anathema to regular physicians, but you will now occasionally have regular physicians who will recommend chiropractors, for example, for certain kinds of conditions. So I think a lot of doctors are open to alternative therapies and methods when they seem to have some efficacy. And certainly from a historical point of view, historians and physicians looking at other medical cultures, whether they're in Asia or Africa, indigenous cultures and so forth, are finding that those medicines and those cultures have a history as well, and they need to be understood on their own basis as well as what they can provide for our system of medicine.
I would like to go back to the subject of polio, because Dr. Wilson is a polio survivor. And by the way, I love that term as opposed to victim, which I think was a more usual term in the past.
Well, to some extent, you're a victim when you're under the acute disease, which lasts a couple of weeks. But after that, I think you're a survivor. You're no longer a victim. And polio survivors were very determined not to be victims, but to get on with their lives.
Let me read something from Dr. Wilson's book called Polio in this series, Biographies of Disease. He writes from the first person here. I remember that neighborhood baseball games made accommodations for my inability to run. Dan, you would be about how old at this point?
Well, 7, 8, 9, 10, something like that.
Right, and you contracted the disease at age 5.
At age 5.
So just a couple of years after that. Sometimes I would bat and a teammate would run the bases. Other days I was the permanent pitcher or perhaps the umpire. Since so many childhood games in the 1940s and 1950s were improvised, there was usually a way to include the children who had had polio. That is not to say that there weren't difficult moments. Children can be cruel, and sometimes the polio survivors were taunted for their limps or their hunchbacks. This is from Dr. Wilson's own childhood and some of his memories. And you quote several people in the book and their trials and tribulations as a high school student, how could you get a date, and some other topics of interest.
Well, I think what I discovered when I started doing the history and reading memoirs and narratives of people and doing oral histories with polio survivors is that there were a lot of commonalities in our experience. One of them was that, as I suggested there, that in play, since so much of the play in the 40s and 50s was unorganized. I mean, there was Little League, but that was about it in terms of organized play. You went out in the morning and in the summers, and you played outside until it was time to come in for lunch and come in for dinner, and you had marathon baseball games or whatever it was. But what I found, and in my own experience and in reading these memoirs, is that the kids in your neighborhood, your friends, very quickly adapted so that you could become part of the game. You weren't left on the sidelines, and if that meant somebody had to run for you because you could stand and bat the ball, they did. And I think that was a tribute to the adaptability not only of the polio survivor but to the kids around them. I think schools were tough. A lot of schools were tough to negotiate. If you look at schools that were constructed in the 20s and 30s and 40s, the first thing you see is a flight of stairs. Most schools did not have elevators, so that people who couldn't walk or who had braces or who needed a wheelchair had a great deal of difficulty getting into schools. Schools were not always welcoming. I've seen accounts where principals told polio survivors or their parents that they couldn't come to school because it would be too depressing for the other children to have somebody in a wheelchair or somebody in braces. Dating was often fraught, I think, for polio survivors who were in wheelchairs or who had braces or walked with a limp. I found many accounts where people really didn't date until they were in college or later. The older you got, it seems that the physical differences became less important than they were when you were a teenager. So it could be difficult. It could be difficult to get a summer job because you couldn't do some of the, especially for boys, couldn't do some of the physical things that boys typically did in the summer.
Right. I remember in our neighborhood, and this would be in the Chicago area, there was a boy who was probably a couple of years older than I was in the neighborhood, and he had these difficulties of movement, and I don't recall specifically, but I suspect it was polio. And I remember playing touch football, and he was always the center because he could hike the ball and then stay there. He right. didn't have to run around, and he didn't have to pass, and so on. And he was the permanent center. So it's like what you're talking about, being umpire or being the batter but not necessarily the runner.
And I think that was the great thing about the unstructured play. Unlike today, where so many kids are in soccer teams or Little League or whatever, the kids made it up. We were making it up as we go along. I mean, you'd maybe have three people on a side to begin with, so you had to make it up to start with, whether you were playing football or baseball. So making it up and accommodating the kid who couldn't walk very fast or couldn't run was just another part of the accommodation.
Let's go locally now and talk about some medical history in the Lehigh Valley. Do we have some here of note?
Well, Lehigh Valley was one of the first places to have a homeopathic medical school and hospital. Was here in the 19th century. I don't know the exact dates, but it was one of the first homeopathic institutions. in the country. One of the other things I've found interesting, and this comes through my teaching, is during the influenza, the great influenza epidemic in 1918, there was a army camp of made up of for medical personnel that was housed at what we would call the Allentown Fairgrounds. It was known as Camp Crane. And recently there's been a group at the University of Michigan studying the influenza campaigns in 1918 to try to find cities and places where they did a fairly good job of keeping the influenza rate down in an era before flu vaccines in case we have another epidemic or another pandemic. What worked in 1918 when you didn't have a lot, when you didn't have vaccines? And it turns out that Camp Crane at Allentown Fairgrounds was one of the more successful Army bases in keeping the number of cases and the number of deaths down. Now, they did that a number of ways by separating the beds, by putting people who came down in isolation. They were also helped by the fact that the Allentown Hospital was across the street, so that the very sick patients were sent to the hospital. But they've looked at Camp Crane, they've looked at Bryn Mawr College, they've looked at Princeton, they've looked at a number of other Army bases to try to understand how we could reduce the toll of influenza if we get another epidemic in which we don't yet have a vaccine. And so Camp Crane in Allentown is one of those places.
Speaking of vaccines, of course, the big one for people with poliomyelitis is the Jonas Salk vaccine. And that came along just about at the time that you contracted polio, didn't it?
It came. It was approved for use in April of 1955. In the fall of 1955, they were giving the vaccine in northern Wisconsin, but there was a shortage of vaccines. So they made a good public health decision, which was to give the vaccine only to children going to school because they'd be the most likely to come in contact with somebody who had the virus. I was too young to go to school, so didn't get the vaccine and came down with the virus in September of 1955.
So are you saying that if you had entered school a year or two earlier that you possibly would not have had polio at all?
I would have had the vaccine and very likely would not have had polio.
Wow.
So matter of bad timing.
Timing is everything, isn't it? Yes. This is Dr. Daniel Wilson from Muhlenberg College. He's a historian, professor of history, and he covers many different areas of history. The one that we're talking about this evening is the history of medicine. And I bet you didn't know that was taught on the undergraduate level, but it is. We have about 10 minutes left now of Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we welcome Bill D'Autremont-Smith once again to our studio. Bill, you've had a long day.
I've had a pretty long day, yes, and it'll be longer. We have more to go until 9 when we have the Pledge Central open. Celtic Fair coming up, and we're looking for more support from our Celtic music fans. But I have the pleasure right now, a thank you. Al from Allentown renewed his membership, and I think he's known to perhaps both of you. But Al has renewed his membership. So thank you, Al. That's two donations we've had within the course of Lehigh Valley Discourse. We were looking for 5, so 3 more we are looking for. 610-758-8810 or securely online at wdiy.org.
Thank you very much, Al. Great to hear from you and to get your pledge in here.
And I think we have a testimonial from John Stopher, right? Do we have that lined up, Ray?
Yes, we do.
Okay, let's take a listen to John Stopher.
Hi, I'm Northampton County Executive and WDIY member John Stopher. I'm here today to encourage you to please pledge your financial support for WDIY during this spring membership drive. The station is an important part of our community, providing the Lehigh Valley with NPR news, local public affairs, programming, and of course, great music. If you count on WDIY to be there like I do, to keep you informed and entertained, Please do your part and become a member today.
To pledge your support, please call 610-758-8810 or go to wdiy.org.
So please follow John Stopher's lead of being a member of WDIY. You can do that. You can join him by calling 610-758-8810 or securely online at wdiy.org.
WDIY is really a unique resource in the Lehigh Valley, and we cooperate with many different organizations here. And one of the things we're doing right now, Bill, is we are planting trees people who become members or renew their memberships.
Absolutely right. We will plant a tree for every donation during this pledge drive. This is the fifth spring drive that we have partnered with Pennsylvania's Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. And they will be providing the trees and working with us. We'll be planting trees this year along the Jordan Creek up in the Schnecksville area in the Trexler Nature Reserve up there along the Jordan Creek.
And our number to call to pledge your support is 610-758-8810.
Bill, if you live in that part of the Lehigh Valley, we spread the trees all around the valley.
Exactly.
We've done Allentown, we've done Bethlehem, we've done Easton. We went right up towards Slatington along the D&L Trail last year, and this year it's the turn of the northwest area around Schnecksville.
Now, Bill, when I think of planting trees, I'm thinking a dozen, maybe a couple dozen. How many trees are we talking about here?
We've planted 2,000 trees so far, and we anticipate planting at least another 500. Based on getting 500 donations during this pledge drive, 500 trees will be planted. So each donation, we will thank you with a tree planting. That tree is going to grow and improve the environment here in the Lehigh Valley. As opposed to getting a coffee cup or a t-shirt or a cap or a mug or a CD, we're not sending you something material. The other good point about it is, one, we're not sending you something material, but secondly, you are not directly receiving the thank you gift. It's going into the community. So that means all of your deduction is tax deductible. You don't have to remove off it the value of a gift that we give back to you. So all of your money goes to support programming here on WDIY. But at the same time, your gift triggers a tree being planted here in the Lehigh Valley.
Great point. And our number to call with your pledge of support is 610-758-8810. You can also go online and pledge securely at WDIY.org. Won't you please do that this afternoon? It'll make you feel good. It'll make us feel great. Ray and I love coming in here and doing Lehigh Valley Discourse. We have such interesting guests. So thank you for your support.
Three more before 7 p.m. That's what we're looking for. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. We have just a few minutes left now with Dr. Daniel Wilson, and we're talking about the history of medicine and why study the history of medicine. Dan, are there different medical histories? What kinds of medical history are there?
Well, there's sort of the institutional history, the history of a hospital, for example. One could write the history of St. Luke's or Sacred Heart or Lehigh Valley Hospital. There are the histories of disease, polio, multiple sclerosis, cancer, and so forth. There's the history of public health, which we haven't talked about, but the whole development of public health from sanitation to vaccination and those sorts of things. There's the history of nursing, the history of physical therapy. Those sorts of things have a history. I have a good friend who does the history of nursing, for example. There's the history of, and one of the things that's become increasingly important is looking at the experience of having a disease. I mean, I've looked at, my first book was on polio, was all about the survivors of polio. And increasingly, we're finding histories of the people, what it's like to have multiple sclerosis, what it's like to have cancer of various sorts. It's a very different experience to have the disease as opposed to treating the disease. And that experience has changed over time. For example, tuberculosis. Initially, before it was realized it was contagious, people with tuberculosis stayed in their families, they stayed in the community. Then when they realized it was contagious, but before they had antibiotics, people were, if they could, they were sent off to the mountains or to the deserts, to sanitaria, to try to recover their health. And then, of course, with the development of antibiotics, you could treat it locally. You could treat it with a course of antibiotics. The problem now with tuberculosis is that many strains of tuberculosis have become resistant to the antibiotics. And so now you have to develop new strategies to treat tuberculosis. You can't simply give somebody a course of antibiotics. And so, again, there's a history of treating tuberculosis, the different ways it's treating. But your experience of tuberculosis is going to be very different if you're in the 19th century or if you're in the sanitarium era or if you're in the antibiotic era. So the experience of having that disease will shift as well.
We haven't talked today about the whole issue of anesthesia. I suppose that's another topic that you could develop as a matter of history.
Well, anesthesia was developed in the late 19th century. Actually, the United States was some of the first places that anesthesia was used. And that, of course, anesthesia makes surgery possible.
Well, the other day, Dan, I was at the dental office, and all I could think of was, I don't want to imagine whatever he's going to do in my mouth without anesthesia.
Well, in the Civil War, the key for surgeons, amputation was speed, because they were amputating without anesthesia.
And that might mean pulling teeth out or
pulling teeth out without anesthesia as well.
I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Daniel Wilson from Muhlenberg College, enlightening us on the topic of studying the history of medicine. Dan, thanks so much for coming over to Eclectic South Bethlehem.
Thank you, John.
It's been fun, Ray, once again.
Of course.
Tell our listeners that we hope that you can join us every Thursday, different hosts coming up on Thursdays. Ray and I are here on the fourth Thursday of the month, and we always have interesting guests. So we'll look for you next time. And remember to be gentle with your neighbor.